Welcome to the Talking Gardens Chelsea podcast with me, Stephanie Mahon. This time, I'm talking with Chris Beardshaw, garden designer, horticulturist, broadcaster and Chelsea Flower Show veteran. I started by asking him about the theme of his garden for this year's show.
Well, the theme of the garden this year at Chelsea is very much something that I was unfamiliar with, and it's for quite a small charity called Myeloma UK. And myeloma is one of those blood cancers which is very rarely spoken about, and very few people have come across it. And obviously you tend to come across it in the worst possible circumstances when you've been diagnosed with it. And it's an extraordinary thing that there's about 3,000 people a year in the UK who die from myeloma. As I say, it's a blood cancer. And it has a debilitating effect, particularly around the bone marrow and bone strength. So as a consequence, partially because it's not easily detected, people tend to get diagnosed with myeloma as a consequence of going to see a clinician or going to see their doctor about something else. You know, they've had a fall or they've got backache or you know, whatever it is, and think that it's, you know, a slip disc or something that hasn't recovered. And as a consequence, following the investigations, they then tend to get the diagnosis. So it's an unusual charity, really, in so much as it's not very much spoken of, and yet the charity does a fantastic job of helping people with this really rare and an unusual condition, which is really, it's a very debilitating condition. And the one thing that is, I suppose, extraordinary and is quite a challenge when you're trying to portray the kind of joy of a garden in the traditional sense at something like Chelsea, is the fact that there is no cure for myeloma. So unlike a lot of charity ventures, when you can sort of reflect somebody's passage through a particular condition or experience through a point in their life, and there is a point of light at the end, if you like. With something like myeloma, to be blunt, there isn't, because at the moment there is no cure. It's one of the things that the charity is trying to bring awareness of and raise money for is to obviously seek out that cure. But at the moment, there is no cure. So I was asked if I would do a garden at Chelsea in somewhat unusual circumstances. And for those that have followed Chelsea over the last couple of years, they'll have noticed that the Project Giving Back charitable initiative has been a really great breath of fresh air going through the show, and has sponsored many gardens, large and small, and other exhibits as well. And it really sort of revitalized.
For mostly for charitable causes, isn't it?
It is for charitable causes, absolutely. And it's the sort of premise of the organization was really to give those lesser known charities or charities that aren't frequently seen at something like Chelsea Flower Show, to give them a platform, you know, to give them a foundation and a stage from which to advertise themselves. And to sort of raise awareness. And in a way, it was the Project Giving Back initiative was an initiative that was set up to try and counter the sort of, well, I suppose, the perceived over-commercialization of the show. And so it's a wonderful experience to having gone through last year when we did a garden for the RNLI. And, you know, it's a fantastic project, the Project Giving Back initiative, but you only get one hit at it. So, you know, you're invited as a designer, or you apply as a designer and you put your package together, and then you get through the selection panels and so on and so on, which we did last year. But this year, so as a consequence of doing last year, in fact, I didn't expect to be doing it again, certainly not for Project Giving Back. And very late, we got a call from Project Giving Back, and one of the key individuals who really was the initiator of the whole Project Giving Back concept was, had come off of our RNLI garden, felt that they had a slip disc or a bad back, went to their clinician and got diagnosed as a myeloma sufferer. And so this is an unusual project, really, because it's an extra. to all of the other Project Giving Back gardens, and is something that has a very special reason for its existence. And that's that, you know, one of the people who really started this sort of ball rolling is themselves suffering with this particular condition. And initially, because I wasn't familiar with the condition, and it also wasn't clear what the ask was as far as Project Giving Back was concerned. It was a very sort of guarded request, asking really and sort of generalities of, did we know anything about cancers and anybody who designed cancer gardens and so on? And to which I said, well, you know, I haven't ever done anything like that. And so the request sort of fell silent for a short while. And then when they came back and said, actually, one of the founders has just very simply said, you know, and this is the sort of, you know, the killer statement, to which I could say nothing other than yes. One of the founders was suffering with myeloma and had very clearly said that the one thing that would help them get through the darkness of winter and the uncertainty of the condition was to be secure in the knowledge that they could spend May standing on one of my gardens.
What a wonderful invitation to, because, you know, I know it's your 25 years this year since you did your first Chelsea Garden, and I believe it's the 25th anniversary of the Myeloma UK charity as well.
Yeah.
I mean, 25 years, a quarter of a century.
Don't say it like that. That sounds extraordinary.
And you've done so many show gardens in that time. How have you seen things change in that time from doing your first Chelsea at the show?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really interesting question because it has changed and it's changed significantly. And, you know, in the days when I did my first show garden in very, very similar sort of circumstances, really, in terms of, you know, I shouldn't have been there, didn't expect to be there. And then it was a sort of last minute request. And I was a lecturer at Pershore College, and which at the time was one of the sort of premium horticultural colleges in the country. And I was lecturing a group of students, and Pershore College always had a large garden at Chelsea Flower Show at that time. And the late, great Peter Seabrook came along with £500 and said that there was a slot that had, I don't know who had dropped out, but somebody had dropped out, and could Pershore College put on an additional garden to fill that vacant plot? And so my vice principal came along to my office, and he was a fairly sort of forthright individual, and he pretty much told me as a junior lecturer that this is what I was going to do. And I was teaching design. I mean, I trained as a landscape architect, and I was teaching design to HND and HNC and degree students. So it wasn't the design that was a challenge. It was just the fact that we had £500 to and only about, crikey, I think about 3 months to pull it off. We didn't have any transport. We didn't have any growing space. The students that I got to use were commercial horticulture students who were more used to overseeing the concerns of, woolly aphid on Bramley apple trees than they were designing Chelsea show gardens. So it was a complete surprise to them too. And we just decided to have a go. And the only thing that Peter Seabrook had said to us was he was producing a series of gardens, and the theme of our garden had to be Dig for Victory and had to capture that spirit, that sort of post-war or shortly post-war spirit of turning over our gardens to allotments effectively and capturing the spirit of the sort of mid to late 40s. And so we begged, borrow and stole. We dug up plants out of hedgerows and compost heaps and all sorts of things in order to make it realistic. And what was really lovely was that the students had no expectations of how this thing was going to go. They just threw themselves into it. Because they were commercial horticulturists, they knew how to grow plants. And we'd been given a somewhat unstable multi-span glass house that I think very soon after we'd finished with it was demolished for structural reasons. And that was the only growing space that we had. No heat, nothing at all. We constructed this little, very modest little garden. And one of the things that two things that I remember, one of them, I think would probably get me thrown out of Chelsea if I tried it this year, was when we arrived in a borrowed van, because we didn't have any transport. When we arrived in a borrowed van, we pulled up the shutters on the back of the Luton van, and a cloud of whitefly came out the back of the van, and the plants, the tomatoes and the cucumbers and so on that we'd been growing had at the very last minute got to an infestation of whitefly, which seemed to enjoy the somewhat ameliorated climate of central London. And so we stood for a moment just thinking, are we going to unload this and just kind of potentially infest the entire Chelsea showground with whitefly, or are we going to do something about it? So we waited until everyone had gone home, and we were the last lorry to offload our stock. And it was just getting dark, and we sort of scurried our plants and corralled them to just inside the pavilion door. And then we went and scoured skips. And in those days, when you were building gardens, there were plenty of skips around, and people threw any unwanted plant material into the skips. And we found a whole batch of calendulas, the pot marigold, that had been thrown in the skip, that's clearly somebody was using, and then they, you know, finished with them, or they got surplus or whatever it was. So we surrounded our plants with a moat of calendulas and went home for the evening. And when we came back the next morning, there wasn't a whitefly to be seen on any of our plants, but the whitefly were all over the calendulas. So we very quickly just picked them up and put them back in the skip. So a great lesson in companion planting and pest control. So we, you know, I remember that it very much was, you know, we were flying by the seat of our pants. It really was the first time for anybody doing that sort of thing. And then, of course, the royal party came around. I think in those days, the Chelsea Flower Show was filmed by Channel 4. And the royal party came around rather more informally than they do now. And we had some of the royals come onto the garden. Prince Charles, as he was, came onto the garden and suggested that he quite liked the way that we were growing our tomatoes. And he went to reach out for some of the tomatoes, and I nearly had to slap his hand because the tomatoes in transit had fallen off the trusses. So we'd got them fruiting very, very early, of course, fruiting in May. And we had decided that we needed just a few tomatoes on these trusses. So I sent one of the students off to a certain superstore up the road, a certain supermarket up the road. It's famous for its quality fruit and veg. And we got some florist's wire, and we wired a few trusses of tomatoes onto our
shocking admission, my goodness.
And which is why, you know, when the prince came onto the garden, I had to persuade him to go for the raspberries instead of the tomatoes, because for fear of our ploy being exposed.
That's amazing. And of course, you know, things have changed quite a bit since then. I mean, I know back in the day, there was no thought given to the fact that you would repurpose things. You know, everything was just sort of thrown in the skip. Whereas now, an awful lot of the time, as I know what's happening with your show garden this year, they get sort of taken apart and repurposed in different places. Is there anything else you can think of that you sort of recognise as a really big change in those 25 years?
I think that the move away from the gardens, if you just speak of the gardens being created by gardeners. And in those days, there were a few designers who you know, peddled their wares as pure designers. But the vast majority of people were horticulturalists, growers, colleges. They weren't out and out designers. So I think that's a major shift, that there is a real blossoming in the design sphere, and an understanding from the public's perspective of the importance of quality design. I think also the expectations of, you know, what is to be achieved at the show. In those days, you could, you know, there was a certain sympathy, I suppose, if the weather had been poor either in the build up or in the season leading up to the show. And now you just, you know, if you tried to say, well, it's been a cold season or a wet season, people just shrug and say, well, you needed to sort it out. You know, there's virtually no sympathy at all. Everyone, of course, is in theoretically the same boat. But I think those elements really stand out for me, the sort of overall professionalism, the ambition, of course, has increased. The budgets have increased, the expectations, you know, and in fairness, the RHS process of embarking on a relationship with the designer or the scheme executor has changed too. And it's now much more of a partnership. In those days, you felt privileged to be at the show, you know, and you were left in no uncertain terms that actually somebody was doing you a favor to let you into the show. And now there's a much more sort of welcome atmosphere. There's an atmosphere of you know, I suppose, an industry working together, as, you know, Chelsea being the main stage, worldwide stage, really, for the industry, whether it's growing or designing or exhibiting, etc. So I think there's a much more sort of holistic approach, really. And I think, you know, so an improvement in the way that the gardens are produced. The sad thing is the loss of the nurseries and those long-term growers, you know, the likes of the Hilliers and the Knotcuts and so on, who were just there for, you know, seemingly forever, producing the most lavish exhibits. And I think, you know, it's tough for growers to be at the show, to man the stands and to produce the stock that's necessary. And of course, Chelsea, for those that haven't been, is one of the shows, I think it's probably the only show in the UK where you can't buy anything. Well, actually, that's not true. You can buy a pair of wellies and a knife and, you know, a carrier bag, but anything green, any plant material, you can't buy. And I think that's really been a big issue for the nurseries, that they can't make money from sales as you can at something like Hampton Court or Gardeners World Live or Harrogate or wherever it is. And so they rely on taking orders. And of course, in the sort of internet savvy age, people go up to a wonderful nurseryman who's spent all half his life growing a particular rarity, ask questions, take a picture of the plant name, and then go home, tap it into their search engine, and then buy it from the cheapest source. And so the nursery really just see themselves as shop windows and something that's, it's just not economic for them to be there. And I think that's a real shame. Because that's the heart of our industry. You know, I started off as a nurseryman. From the age of 13, I worked in commercial nurseries. And I think that the skill set that's required to produce plants, the breadth of plants that we grow in the UK, to the quality that we are able to produce them in the UK, is just fantastic and very, very rarely celebrated. And if it should be celebrated anywhere, it should be at Chelsea. And in a way, that's what we try and do with our plant material in our gardens. It's all about the plants. And it's really an exhibition of and a celebration of how well the nursery trade in the UK, because the vast majority of our stock is UK sourced and grown, how well they can produce their stock. So we really love to partner with nurseries, you know, large and small, have a great relationship with them and work with them to produce the plant material. And you know, it's important for me that they feel completely embedded and enmeshed in the project, and that they understand why we're doing it and what the cause is and why particular plants have been chosen and how those plants are going to be woven together in a tapestry. And it's, you know, that's a far cry from, you know, nipping to the local kind of market and picking up a few trolleys of, you know, whatever's available. It really is a relationship from months and months ago, you know, at this point with just, 2 months to go before we kick into the show. You know, we start talking to the nurseries as soon as we get confirmation that anybody is interested in doing a garden and start just sort of narrowing down that plant palette and working with them to see, you know, what can we grow, which is a real kind of surefire performer, because you need an awful lot of those things which are just relentless, you know, the kind of cockroaches of the horticultural world that you can throw anything at them seasonally and they just perform. So you need a good bevy of those, but equally you need some oddities, something that's unusual, which just brings a kind of sparkle to the horticulturalists. And it's those are the sorts of schemes that I've enjoyed doing over the years, where we've had that opportunity to put some of the unusual plants in, and you can see people standing on the boundary of the garden, reading all of the plant species, you know, kind of mentally ticking them off as being able to identify them. And then they hit one that they haven't seen before, and you can see them kind of lean forwards and get their notebook out or their camera or whatever it is, or start to sort of question themselves, sometimes recognizing the genus, but not necessarily the species of the cultivar. And that's exciting, to be able to bring just a few unusual plants to the palate, but always exhibiting them in a way that they could be grown at home. And that is, I would say, the most important thing for me is that wherever you take a photograph on the garden, whatever you're taking a photograph of, that little community of plants that you've chosen to fill your lens with could be grown if you've got the same conditions that we are suggesting that we have in our garden. And so, you know, we deliberately don't force plants. We don't manipulate them. We don't lecture them on how they should be performing. We allow them to be themselves. And the personality of the plant is something that I really enjoy working with.
I think that's a big change from a few decades ago as well, isn't it? That, you know, before you might see things that wouldn't necessarily grow together or weren't particularly seasonal, whereas now I think the RHS absolutely expects that it should be seasonal and that it should be possible. You're talking about things that people were picking out. I remember your Best in Show garden in 2018, there was a rhododendron that grabbed everybody's interest in particular, and just at the entrance to the garden. But speaking of planting, why don't you tell us about your cockroaches and unusual special things that you're going to have in your garden this year for Myeloma UK?
Okay, well, I think that, you know, the term horticultural cockroach is not at all a derogatory one in terms of the plant material.
I think we're going to adopt it on the magazine now. I'm going to be asking people, what are your cockroaches?
Yeah, they're just things that, you know, that you could, you can rely on them, and they're just fantastic performers. I mean, acanthus, for instance, you know, you can play around with something like acanthus rouledon. That's a bit more difficult, but you know, acanthus mollis is just an absolute mainstay. So if you want something which has got that slightly relaxed, oversized texture, glossy leaf, just bursting a little bit of light, a way off into a dappled shade. It's quite cheeky. It will perform in really quite deep shade. I remember going to Frederick Gibbard's garden years and years ago, and he'd got them growing in a woodland, you know, in deep, deep shade under poplars. And you know, it just struck me. You don't get great flowers on them if you grow them in deep shade, but you do get wonderful foliage, especially if the soil is deep and rich and sort of fertile. So those are the sorts of things that I would refer to as being the sort of, you know, one of the cockroaches, I suppose. Things like the begonias as well. You know, we've got some of the begonias which are really good at just, again, giving you that sort of coarse texture. Brunneras. I'm just looking down my plant list here, actually, and the garden is broadly divided into two, not two equal parts. The first part is adjacent to Main Avenue, so that's the sort of 10 meter boundary. And that is a traditional sort of sun-loving border. So that's where you've got things like your angelicas standing proud and your euphorbias and so on. You know, those are the sort of traditional big Jekyll-esque border plants, backed off by a yew hedge. And then you get into the garden proper, which is a dappled shade woodland garden. It's sort of curated woodland, I suppose, an informal curated woodland. So we've got a really odd mix of plants that are really good sun lovers and also dappled shade and deep shade. Some that really don't like having their head out underneath the canopy of anything else. So it gives me an opportunity to play with all sorts of unusual forms and some things as well that are not fully hardy. So things like Dahlia imperialis, for instance, Aspidistras, we're putting in the garden. Some forms of the more hardy, but still not fully hardy, begonias. You know, these are plants which, from a textural point of view, they give me such a bounce in the garden. And they're such a contrast to those little kind of ankle ticklers, the things like the Adoxus, for instance, or the very small Salaginellas, which sort of migrate through the paving and just, I suppose, just wrap around the skirt of some of those slightly taller plants. So we're playing on all sorts of different levels: sun, dappled shade, and also hierarchy of canopy as well. So it's a joy actually to go down the plant list, because, you know, if my garden was full of this group of plants, I'd be very chuffed, to be honest.
And when we're standing in front of the garden at Chelsea at the show and we're looking at all of this beautiful planting, you know, what is sort of the journey through the garden going to be like? If you could talk me through the design. You say it's in two parts, so what else can we expect?
Well, as you stand on Main Avenue, on your 10-metre frontage, what you're looking at is, I suppose, what has come to be expected of as a sort of traditional, largely herbaceous, slightly graminoid, little bit of shrub border, 3 meters deep, 10 meters wide. And it's in its sort of billowing mass, quite formal. So if you think of the kind of Jekyll-esque style of scallops in their drifts, so it's a kind of almost a semicircle when you look at it in plan of plants, which then tier from largely tall at the back to small at the front, with a few just sort of things to sort of erupt through. But it's largely a kind of, it's all about showmanship, and it's all about really enjoying being in that sunshine. However, it's backed off by a yew hedge, and there is a very minor little slip path, I suppose you could describe it as, which is, I hesitate to say stepping stone, but that's essentially what it is. It's kind of fragments of stone with mosses and things like Pratia running through, with an invitation to explore beyond or into the depths of that border. And as you travel deeper into the garden and you emerge from the border between the yew hedge, you emerge into this, well, almost a kind of, it's an eternal spring. It's a woodland garden of eternal spring. So a canopy created by multiple trees. So we've got, I think there are 9 trees in the garden this year, which sounds like an awful lot, but they all perform a slightly different function, and they're all very different. So from the back corner, where we've got a very statuesque, you know, probably, 12-metre tall multi-stem Cercidophyllum. It'll be there as long as the frost doesn't bite it in the last week or so, which is it's a nightmare with Cercidophyllum, honestly. You'd never, ever put Cercidophyllum in a show garden. I should know better by now. And as you come forward, we've got the twisted stems of things like the hornbeam, Carpinus betulus. We've got several varieties of acers, all at different shapes and sizes, to tier down from sort of 9 metres down to about 4 metres. We've also got a really lovely ginkgo biloba, which is just one of my favourite trees. And this is a female form of the ginkgo biloba. And
that's not the one with the stinky berries.
This is the one with the stinky berries. So
they won't be stinky at Chelsea, thank goodness. It's an autumn fruit, isn't it?
You'll be safe to come onto the garden. They won't have berries. But for anyone who's ever grown ginkgo, they'll know that the females are very statuesque. You know, there's something very, very proud about a female ginkgo. They stand relatively upright. They're pretty consistent. This one's a lovely multi-stem. And it's about 9 metres high and about 6-7 metres diameter. And they're just the most elegant and beautiful plants. So, you know, at any point in life, whether it's that sort of emergent fresh green of spring or whether it's that wonderful butter gold of autumn. But it stands perfectly because it's female. The male forms, if you've grown them, are wayward. I mean, they're just horrors. You can't trust them to do anything. They are so ramshackle in the way that they grow. If ever you've
there are
seen
women
a ginkgo
up and down the country nodding along now. Yes, that sounds about right, Chris.
I hate to draw comparisons. I'll leave others to do that, but you're absolutely right. I grew a male ginkgo years and years ago, and it got up to about 4 or 5 meters, something like single straight stem, up to about 4 to 5 meters. And then for no apparent reason, the apical bud just turned through 180 degrees, came down, touched the floor, hit the floor, and then went back up again. So I just had a perfect S-shaped ginkgo stem. And it was, I mean, that is typical of the way that the males grow. They just don't know which way they should be going. It's extraordinary. They're characterful. And you sort of admire them for their sort of personality, but they wouldn't win any beauty contests, let's say that. As you walk through this little slip path, that's the tree that greets you. And it, in a way, its purpose is that it prevents you from looking any further into the garden. So just going back to that notion of, you know, myeloma is a condition without a cure. It seemed, in a way, folly to have a garden with a very strong axial link. So I wanted to create a garden which was somewhat circuitous and allowed the eye and also the feet to wander and to meander through the garden. That we, you know, in meandering through, we see so much more. And we're encouraged to look at the detail left and right, rather than marching up to, you know, an axial reward, which is a piece of sculpture or water feature or whatever it is, which we so often see in gardens at Chelsea, you know, celebrating that 22-metre length. And I wanted this to be a garden of, I suppose, little cameos, if there was a horticultural equivalent of slow food, then this garden is it. You know, you really It's a garden for an individual to walk through. So it's not the path is only 900 mil wide, and you're going to have your ankles tickled by plants coming in left and right. You're going to have to duck under the boughs of trees and around stems in order to navigate through the garden on a very informal, circuitous path. There are various resting points along the way. We've got two buildings, two neoclassical buildings, which are, we're referring to as temples, a sort of celebratory buildings. It's sort of celebrating the passage so far and your experience with the garden so far. The first one, about halfway up the garden, is quite monochromatic, and it contains a little bit bespoke piece of artwork, which is hand-cut leaves in gold leaf of all of the plants which are included in the garden. So the artist has very carefully taken each individual leaf, and we have some gold foil, which is clipped in the shape of each leaf, then mounted on a malachite backdrop to give us a three-dimensional side-lit sculpture, which is set back into the temple wall. And it's a sort of reminder, I suppose, of the beauty and the joy of the plants that you've encountered thus far. And as you stand in that little temple and turn round with the artwork behind you, what you're greeted by is an octagonal reflective pool at ground level, which has the ferns and the hostas, xanthosticias, iris, that sort of thing all around it, very informal. And you've got the canopies of the acers, and in this particular case, the ginkgo and acornas, reflected in the pool. And the idea, as anybody who's studied garden history will know, the idea is that reflective water features have for centuries been used as this link between the earthly individual and the heavenly individual. You know, bringing heaven to earth is essentially the function of a reflective pool. And so we know that for anyone who is diagnosed with a condition and their shoulders might drop, their eye line comes down, there's a sense of frustration perhaps, and our eye line really goes down in it, groundward rather than away from the horizon. And if we can catch their eye in a reflective pool, which perfectly encapsulates all of the kind of joy of that sort of multifaceted canopy with the azure blue skies and wisps of cloud, and in the case of Chelsea, parakeets flying over, you know, that sort of thing. And just remind people that actually, whatever emotional state you're in, there is a world out there of real beauty and real detail. And, you know, it's there to be enjoyed and to be drunk in, really, and to absorb at this sort of super slow pace. But equally, that reflective surface is a real reminder that there's a fragility to life, which, you know, anyone who's been diagnosed with myeloma will know. And that fragility is, you know, perfectly encapsulated on some of those rather wonderful May mornings when the sun is coming up from behind the London planes, which strike a very elegant line at the back of the gardens on Main Avenue. And the sun rises behind them, and the mist just hangs on a warm May morning, just hangs in the shadow of those trees. And that mist sometimes gathers on the ends of the pointed leaves of things like acers. And so you get a droplet of water, a single droplet of water off one acer leaf hitting that reflective pool, and suddenly the illusion is shattered. And that rather beautiful reminder, I think, that there's sort of perfection, but there's sort of a delicacy about that that perfection. And it's a very ephemeral relationship that we have with our idea of paradise and our idea of perfection. So that it's, in a way, the garden is building us up, because it's giving us confidence, it's encouraging us to look at detail, it's encouraging that sort of lavish appreciation of that curated nature. But it's also reminding us of the reality of life, that, you know, nature is fragile, we are part of nature, we are equally fragile. And so you have to enjoy the moment that you're in and not worry about the moments you haven't yet had.
And you mentioned that there was two temples, so I assume that you continue down the slip path, as you've called it. It would be interesting to hear more about maybe the materials that you've chosen to use, you know, what your temples are constructed out of, what we might find in the second temple.
So the path that you're walking over is very informal. It's actually charred oak. So it's blocks of charred oak. So it almost is consumed by the woodland ground cover. You know, very dark, very submissive, and the plants sort of mingling between. So although it's a solid path and it has that kind of beautiful texture of charred and trodden oak, it's not a showpiece at all. It just gives us a firm enough surface to progress on. The center of the temples becomes stone. That's a sort of an English limestone, which itself is enriched in fossil detail. So it's got all sorts of little ammonites in it and so on, bivalves, which are encased within this rather sort of muted stone. Then within the stone itself, we've also got a labyrinth of ferns in the first temple that sits at the heart of the first temple. So the first temple is celebration of the passage in the artwork, in the sort of gold leaf of the artwork, and also the idea that a labyrinthine structure, the beautiful calm that just tracing your finger or your foot or your eye over a labyrinth has on the mind in terms of turning left and then right and left and right, and that kind of steadiness of pace, which encourages us to become absorbed in the sort of luxuriant nature of the fern, contrasting with the limestone surface. And the labyrinth eventually spills out into the garden. So again, it takes us from a slightly emotionally challenged moment to something which is leading us back out into the garden and encouraging us to sort of engage with that kind of wider horizon of the gardenscape outside. And that each of the temples is constructed in a very lightweight structure, actually. There's no foundation. It's a very contemporary method of building. It's a cementitious board. So it's only 12 mil cementitious board on a timber frame. And the cementitious board is clad in a product which is, I suppose, best described as a kind of an external wallpaper. So it looks as though it's got the render of an Italian chapel, a sort of faded grandeur. And in fact, it is a printed fabric which is bonded to the cementitious board, which makes it very lightweight, but it's an external, it's guaranteed for several decades, and a slate roof with then the neoclassical cornicing and a belt cornice and so on. So that both temples, although slightly different in style, have this sort of neoclassical treatment and slightly different wall treatments as well. So we see more colour starting to come through into the second temple. The second temple is right on the 22-metre boundary, so it's as far away from Main Avenue as you can possibly get. And we just start to see sort of watercolour washes coming through on the external render of that building. It's a slightly more grand building, and instead of walking through it, it becomes, in a way, the point at which we're able to pause and reflect on the passage, on the travel through the garden and the experiences of being in that particular garden, the kind of emboldening effect, the enveloping effect that the garden has had. And it's enriched that temple. So colours start to really shine out. There's a radiancy and a warmth to the colours in and around that particular temple. For instance, the back wall of the temple is painted in a tapestry of peonies, which reflects some of the peonies which are planted out in the wider garden. But here the peonies are, each peony flower is about, 4 feet in diameter. I mean, it's a really sort of beautiful piece of work in rich teals and purples and creams. And within that temple, there is a coffer, so there's a recess in the ceiling, and the ceiling coffer is lit, so we have a very delicate light coming around that coffer, and from the recess in the ceiling hangs a sculpture, a light sculpture, so it's a gold sculpture on pieces of thread. And there's a slight animation to it. So as the wind blows, as the breeze blows, as it so often does on those sort of warm, balmy Chelsea evenings, I'm ignoring all of the horrible ones, I'm just hanging on to the warm, balmy evenings. You just get the slight animation in, again, structures of leaves in porcelain and gold hanging in a perfect formation and lit from the ceiling coffer, casting a very ephemeral and somewhat mesmeric pattern on the paving in that particular temple. So it becomes, in a way, a place to stand and contemplate, to reflect, to gather your thoughts, to feel emboldened and to feel enriched by the exposure to the level of detail and the enjoyment of finding your passage through the garden and then reviewing that passage and possibly just, well, hopefully working towards changing somebody's perspective on the values of life and you know, that very delicate balance between the fragility of life and the stoic, really emboldened mind that you need in order to be able to go through life. And I think that's where, for me, that's where the real beauty of life lies, is appreciating the delicacy of something like nature and the plants that are in the garden, but also allowing that to create a very reinforced and well-structured, a very robust mindset to allow you to face, you know, whatever challenges life throws at you.
And what part of the show garden at present, obviously we're recording this but just before the show, what part of the design is keeping you up at night at the moment? is there a particular element that you're worried about or, you know, maybe you're sort of a little concerned about the build on or?
I think in terms of you know, being kept awake, I've always been, I think from the very first garden that I did, you know, 25 years ago, the very first garden, I've always been a very firm believer in the fact that you have to be very positive about what is being created. And stress and anxiety and worry doesn't solve any problems. And so you know, when you're, as an example, the plant material is always going to be a challenge because we don't know what the season's going to throw at us. Even with just a couple of months to go, you know, the plants are barely out of the pots and it could all go horribly wrong. But you sit, I suppose, safe in the knowledge that the broad selection of plants that you've made covers a multitude of bases. So if one of my choice specimens doesn't make it, gets a last minute, you know, battering by wind or frost, or on one occasion I had an entire tree that was defoliated by caterpillars overnight. You know, if that sort of thing happens, then you know that you've got a backup and possibly a backup to that backup. And that's all part of the planning process, really. You know, you can only sleep easy if you've been through that process. And you know, for everything, you've got a reserve and you've got a contingency and you've got a contingency to that contingency. And that makes it doesn't take any of the challenge away, but it does make it bearable to embark on the creation of garden. Because, you know, let's face it, I mean, creating a garden in the middle of London to such a high standard in a climate which can be, well, fickle would be a very generous way of describing it. It doesn't make any sense. If you went as a business proposition to any self-respecting bank manager and said, I want to borrow, you know, whatever money to go and do a garden at Chelsea Flower Show, they would laugh you out of the office. It doesn't make any sense to do it. And so you sort of have to hang on to that fact that this is an event. It's a spectacle. It's a carnival which has emerged organically over generations. And it's the admiration of the world. And it's the sort of peculiarly eccentric English character which has sort of allowed that to prosper in a way. And I think that, you know, you could say the same about many of the gardens and of course extend that out to other nations as well. It's sort of the eccentricities of these islands that means that we've got the broadness of garden styles. And it's exactly that that's kept something like Chelsea going. So you hang on to that actually, you know, we're all slightly barking mad, to be honest, to even try it. To try it over a period of 25 years with however many gardens it is, 15 gardens or whatever it is just ridiculous. I keep thinking that one day I'm going to grow up and get a proper job. Maybe next year.
That was Chris Beardshaw, who's creating the Myeloma UK A Life Worth Living Garden at this year's Chelsea Flower Show. I'm Stephanie Mahon, and this is Talking Gardens, brought to you by the team behind Gardens Illustrated magazine. Find us on the newsstand or at gardensillustrated.com and follow us to make sure you don't miss an episode.